This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we'll speak with author William Bloom about his book, America's Deadly Export, Democracy.
How many more times will America fall for humanitarian intervention? When, as Bloom points out, what's really going on is American imperialism.
We'll talk with Rick Rowley about the new film, Dirty Wars, The World is a Battlefield.
Rick and the author of the book by the same name, Jeremy Scahill, traveled to Somalia, Yemen, Afghanistan, Iraq, and they have documented the most chilling of stories about how the United States is carrying on through the Joint Special Operations Command dirty secret wars in over 100 countries.
Stay with us.
City Attorney and author Michael Smith.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, Executive Director of the National Lawyers Guild.
And I'm Michael Ratner, President Emeritus of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
Michael, the revelations of, I guess we'll call him whistleblower Snowden, and the NSA spying program in conjunction with major United States information companies has really shaken the civil liberties community and the general public at large. But let's talk about specifically how this relates and impacts the Bradley Manning trial.
Now, I know, Heidi, you're going to address, and we all will, the impact of Snowden's revelations, how important they are, how courageous he is. But I've also been very interested, because we represent WikiLeaks and Julian Assange, and I do, and those are documents from Bradley Manning, is how the public and the media are looking at Ed Snowden compared with Bradley Manning. And it's fascinating to me because there's a lot of support out there for what Snowden revealed, this big program about massive surveillance against all of us, internet surveillance, cyber wars. There's a tremendous amount of support for him. And there's editorials in the Times basically saying it's not treason. There's some congressional movement on this. And I contrast that to Bradley Manning. And I don't have to go too far to contrast it. I was reading a New York Times editorial today saying Snowden's disclosures do not amount to treason. Well, of course, I agree they don't amount to treason, either for moral and political reasons or for technical legal reasons. That's a part of the Constitution. They don't amount to that. But after going on about Snowden and what his program did, they have this line in there. And this is, of course, typical of what the Times has done toward Manning and Julian Assange. The line in parentheses is, quote, he being Snowden, was also not nearly as reckless as Bradley Manning, the soldier on trial on charges with giving classified materials to WikiLeaks, who seemed not to know or care what secret documents he was exposing. So they're accusing Bradley Manning of being reckless and not caring about what documents he was disclosing. Now, that was the editorial today. Then they had a debate among people taking different positions on Snowden. Was it good? Was it bad? And one of the so-called liberals on this, someone named Faiza Patel from the Liberty and National Security Program at the Brennan Center in New York, goes along the same line, saying Snowden, it appears to hear, was more discerning, and he carefully selected documents, and that his claim that it was in the public interest may be more credible than Bradley Manning's. And she goes on like that, that Manning did a data dump. Then she talks about national security perhaps suffering catastrophic harm, and she says that assertion seems more credible in Manning's case. So again, protecting Snowden, who revealed this program of massive surveillance against us, but throwing Bradley Manning, and here's the part that I want to say, throwing Bradley Manning and the war crimes he revealed under the bus. So I want to think about this. There's two points I want to make. One is this whole claim that it was a data dump by Bradley Manning, that he just went into the documents, just dumped everything without knowing what was in them, is false. And I know it's false from sitting at the trial. I heard Bradley Manning testify as to why he did each set of documents, the Iraq war logs, the Afghan war logs, the collateral murder video, which I'm sure many of you have seen, the State Department cables. In each case, he came up with a moral and a political reasons for doing them, because he was seeing and witnessing war crimes. His conscience was bothering him, or he was seeing hypocritical diplomacy that he wanted to reveal. So the idea that people are still accusing Bradley Manning of a data dump is outrageous, and it's actually the prosecutor's position. Let me be clear. In court, the lawyer for Bradley Manning, David Coombs, when he gave his opening, He said, contrary to what the government's saying here, that this was an indiscriminate data dump, this was the conscience of a young man who went through these documents, went through what he was revealing, and was very selective about it. And then he said, you know, yes, 750,000 documents were revealed, but he said Manning could have revealed millions more, millions more. So I don't want to hear again from people like the Brennan Center or this person on the Brennan Center or the so-called liberal New York Times that's liberal towards Snowden, that Bradley Manning did a document dump. The second thing that's going on here, I think it's really important, and I'm interested in hearing other people's thoughts. Look, Snowden did something really important. We've all known or suspected we've been under massive surveillance. We now have it confirmed, and it's as bad or as worse than we could imagine. It's every phone call we make, everyone, every single person in this United States who
every
makes a phone
call. Every keystroke on your computer.
Everything. The whole business. Okay, they have us all. And that's terrible. But it is a surveillance program against us. Yes, it brings in foreigners, of course, but it's against us. What Bradley Manning revealed was U.S. committing war crimes against others. Collateral murder video, murdering Iraqis, murdering 15,000 extra civilians that they wouldn't disclose. I mean, going, you know, documents that indicate U.S. war crimes. And I think it's easier for American people to hear, oh, we're being surveilled, than to care about the fact that America is committing war crimes all over the world, because that actually goes to the heart of a U.S. imperialist country. And I don't think the times and people are ready to hear it. And so when I say they're throwing Bradley Manning under the bus on the claim of document dump, but they're really throwing him under the bus because they don't want to do anything about listening to or prosecuting or holding responsible this government for war crimes. And it's an outrage.
When you compare the recent revelations with what happened under the Nixon administration, and we had the Supreme Court case U.S. v. U.S. District Court that held that the executive was not above the law and could not listen in on Americans, combined with revelations about COINTELPRO and public outrage that at the time resulted in more limitations being placed on law enforcement and intelligence agencies about what data they could gather when they could open investigation. As you all know, we've loosened all of those restrictive guidelines so that over the last 10 or 12 years, spying locally and nationally has become much easier to do. And one of the problems with this revelation is that a lot of the information that is being gathered under the blanket FISA warrants is information that's going to occur in the future. So that you really do...
Explain that. The FISA warrants are the Foreign
Intelligence Surveillance Act warrants, and they cover information up to, say, the next 6 months or a year. So that one of the problems I have with this is that it really does away with any of the standards we usually need, reasonable suspicion or probable cause, to open an investigation. It's saying that we'll open an investigation, and this will be on information that hasn't even happened.
It's a really important point.
And moreover, the order that the NSA got from the FISA court, this order is supposed to be secret into the year 2038.
It's basically, what's that movie, Minority Report?
Exactly.
Where they're going to surveil everybody just in case one of those people might commit a crime. I mean, that's the idea, right?
Right. It's preemptive policing. One of the other dangers, and we have to talk about stored data, so that there's data now that once out there, you can never really get rid of. The government has access to that, as do the corporations, and it's worth noting that corporate intelligence firms or military contractors working with the government comprise about 70% of the budget that is given toward intelligence. So they're doing a lot of our contracting work, as Booz Allen was. We don't know, A, what insidious purposes they may be using that data for. We hear about you can have abuses by corporations in ways we may probably never hear about.
What's happening now, and according to Ed Snowden, they take in huge amounts of data about each of our phone calls and lots of other information about us. And they have this huge database. Now, the claim by Clapper, who is the director of national intelligence, I mean, he lied about the first part, clear, open
right.
lie
right.
about whether they were surveilling Americans. But now he says that we don't actually go into that data about Americans unless we have a probable cause, unless we have some reasonable cause.
Yeah.
But that's just complete junk is what you're saying.
I think it's complete junk. And the other thing to be aware of is that a year from now, say you, Michael Ratner, make a speech that irritates someone in the Obama administration. They have the capacity to then go back and look at your communications things you've uploaded, photos you've taken over the past several years, and if they want, sort of build an argument against you based on the facts at hand. I think that's a problem.
Well, think about it from what you really do. You really focus a lot on demonstrations and what happens about people's protests. And think what this database does for them. If you're organizing a protest in Washington Square or in Berkeley or in wherever it is in the world, they now know every single person that you organize with.
Exactly.
All they have to do is go to Heidi Boghossian.
Right.
They see who you phone call on a particular day. They then have the entire web of people. They can go to those people. They can make informants out of them. They can
That's
entrap
right.
them. They can do anything. It's really staggering to me.
They also know not only who you talked to, but who you hung out with and even who you spent the night with, because they can track everybody and know where they are and when they are. But I wanted to make another point here, and that's a follow the money point. Booz Allen, which is the private contractor that Snowden worked for, Booz Allen is part of the Carlyle Group. The Carlyle Group is a private equity firm that's worth $158 billion. George Bush Sr., Henry Kissinger, a number of people like that that's the ruling class in this country, own a chunk of the Carlyle Group. Well, the Carlyle Group, part of that is Booz Allen, and General James Clapper, what a name, it's like right out of Dr. Strangelove. But Clapper, who's now the head of National Intelligence, used to be a big executive with Booz Allen. And the current head of Booz Allen used to be one of the main guys in the National Security Agency. So this is a revolving door between these big corporations that profit off of government contracts and the government.
That's absolutely right. The overlap between the private sector and the government is huge. And one of the problems is that the private sector has a duty to their shareholders and to their profit versus the government, which is supposed to be beholden to the public interest. So when those two duties converge, who's at loss? The United States public.
Yeah, exactly. Although we get to pay the bill.
I also want to just mention that I think there's been really a commodification of personal information in this country, because as the private sector has grown, developing sophisticated technology that in most cases the government has to hire out contractors because they're the only ones who have the technical expertise to use this information and to analyze it. And so, of course, spying is in these corporations' best interest because it keeps them going. It gives them business. As you're saying, Booz Allen and other large contractors, these are multi-billion dollar businesses for them. So spying is what they do best.
I wanted to make another point, which I think is really central. If the government and their private contractor allies get away with maintaining this kind of what they used to call total information awareness program, when that came up with Admiral Poindexter 11 years ago, it was shot down. But only shot down in people's awareness. It wasn't shot down in reality. It's still going on. And if that continues to go on, if we are unable to reverse what Snowden has revealed, it's truly the end of a free press in this country, because no one is going to talk to an investigative reporter knowing that the government's going to know who they are and when they said it and what they said. So we're really at a historical turning point here. Snowden and Manning and Assange have to be defended with every ounce of our strength.
One other point, Michael, is that a lot of the data that is being collected, stored, resold, used for other purposes, contains a high rate of inaccuracy. That, coupled with the potential for misuse or political use by the government or corporations, is ominous because individuals, A, don't know what the data is, the nature of it, what it says about them, and B, there is no method for them to correct that data. So you're really sort of swimming out there in the dark.
And I spent this last weekend or a week ago out at a conference in Colorado, and they had Julian Assange on the big screen giving a remarkable interview, actually. I mean, one of the most brilliant I've ever heard. And it was after the Snowden revelations that he did it, but before we got the name of Snowden. And he also talked about his book in it, this book called Cypherpunks, which I just recommend because he predicted in this book, or wrote about with others, exactly what happened. A couple of things first about the talk. The talk talks about, and the book does, about the internet as having this incredible potential for democratizing communications among us all, and actually creating a different political space in a way. But going against it is the idea that its central backbone is controlled by governments. And he looks at it like an atomic bomb versus an individual gun. Someone's controlling an atomic bomb, and the governments and corporations are going to want to control this from the vertical way so we can't have this lateral communication. And what's going on now is exactly that struggle, is whether we're going to continue to have an open internet or one that's controlled from the top, in which they take and surveil everything. And so Julian and this book put it into that context, and it's a very good one. So that's one very strong point he made. The second point he was making, which is not as amazingly broad, but even before we knew who the whistleblower was, Ed Snowden and his age, Assange is asked a question in the room. Well, who's winning here? How do you think we can ever counter this? They're just so big and powerful. And he says, well, one of the things you're going to realize is they have to hire people who are young, who understand hacking and computers. And let me tell you, you start hiring thousands of those people, some of those people are not going to have the politics, this is essentially what he said, of the government and others, and they're going to come out. I'm coming back on the bus to the Denver airport an hour later, and I read, all of a sudden, Snowden comes out. He's 29 years old. Exactly the case. So the government isn't going to be able to protect itself. The third point he makes, which is in the book and out there, is about surveillance. And what he says is surveillance is so cheap now to get machines. He gives these examples. You get a decent quality storage of all German telephone calls on a certain kind of computer for 30 million euros, including administrative overhead for pure storage. You can take every German phone call and the administrative stuff for 30 million euros. What he goes on with those examples is to say, they're not going to bother with going after Michael Smith or Heidi Boghossian or Michael Ratner. They're going to do exactly what we now see Ed Snowden says they're doing. It's cheaper for them to take in every communication in the world than to actually look at us individually. And after that, they will then apply their algorithms to that material and dig up whatever they want. And that's exactly what they say. And I'll end on this little section. What he says is the internet is a threat to human civilization. And he says the internet has led revolutions across the world. A crackdown is now in full swing. This is 6 months ago. As whole societies move online, mass surveillance programs are being deployed globally. He said this almost a year ago, actually. Our civilization has reached a crossroads. In one direction lies a future promoting, quote, privacy for the weak and transparency for the powerful. In the other is an internet that transfers power over entire populations to an unaccountable complex of spy agencies and their transnational corporate allies. You can't say it better than what Snowden actually has now revealed is going on.
Snowden's personal story, I think, is important. It's exactly what Julian predicted. Snowden never finished a college. I'm not even sure he finished high school, but he's a real smart guy.
Got a GED.
Right. And he was an idealistic young man. His idealism was misplaced. So he enlists in the army. He wants to fight for freedom in Iraq. And he gets over there and he says, and then I discover that all they were talking about is killing Arabs. So then he joins the intelligence community. And then he realizes what's going on. So that idealism, once misplaced, becomes targeted. And he does exactly what Julian Assange predicted he would do. He stood up for the rest of us in the most brave way. I mean, he said, I'll probably never see my home again. And he took that step.
A bit of activism we want to suggest to people. 60,000 people have already signed a White House petition to pardon Ed Snowden. Now I want people to also sign a similar petition to free or pardon Bradley Manning. They're both at petition/whitehouse.gov. If you're going to do Ed Snowden, do Bradley Manning as well. If you're going to do Bradley Manning, do Ed Snowden.
Repeat that again, Michael.
petition/whitehouse.gov. 60,000 on Snowden, at least I think 25 or 30,000 on Manning, but let's keep those numbers going.
And in the upcoming week, we look forward to more revelations from Mr. Snowden and hopefully more developments both on the activist and legal front.
Our guest, William Blum, is the author of the recently published America's Deadliest Export, Democracy, The Truth About U.S. Foreign Policy and Everything Else. Bill Blum is one of the United States' leading non-mainstream experts on American foreign policy. He left the State Department in 1967, abandoning his aspiration for becoming a foreign service officer because of his opposition to what the U.S. was doing in Vietnam. His book, Killing Hope, U.S. Military and CIA Interventions Since World War II, has received international acclaim. Noam Chomsky called it far and away the best book on the topic. In 1999, Bill was one of the recipients of Project Censor's awards for exemplary journalism. Blum currently sends out a monthly internet newsletter, The Anti-Empire Report. William Blum, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you very much.
Bill, I just want to publicly acknowledge that when Michael Ratner and I did the book on Who Killed Che, How the CIA Got Away with Murder, we really relied on your book, Killing Hope, U.S. Military and CIA Interventions Since World War II. We're grateful to you for doing that, and we're grateful to you for writing your latest book, which just came out, called America's Deadliest Export, Democracy, The Truth About U.S. Foreign Policy and Everything Else. Apart from the claim, everything else, which we'll get into, I wanted to ask you this, because you start off your book saying there really is no secret to American foreign policy. And then you say, the fact is that the United States strives to dominate the world. There is no secret. That's the way it is. And then you go on and you talk about overthrowing foreign governments, overthrowing democratic elections, assassinations, dropping bombs on 30 countries, attempting to suppress popular movements in 20 countries. How did you come to understand and get your perspective on what the United States does around the world?
Well, it began with Vietnam. And very slowly but surely over the years, it built up. The more I researched, the more I found about what we had done, actually, and the more I became upset. Because all this while I was looking to find reasons for it, to explain this weird record. What I was left with at the end was the belief that it's world domination that the U.S. wants, for various reasons. Once you understand that, many things become clearer, much less confusing.
Bill, I have a question. This is Michael Ratner. You know, we deal with a lot of contemporary issues from, semi-contemporary, from, you know, the bombing of Yugoslavia to the recent invasion of Libya. You know, for some reason, which I can't figure out, is people seem to, every time they either, quote, get tricked or they believe the humanitarian intervention reasons or the dictator reasons, and they never go to the very thing that you're talking about is what's really underlying the policy. So can you just give us some perspective? You can talk about those two instances, Yugoslavia and Libya, as two of them, but I can't figure out why all our, even our liberal media, I mean, goes along with it all the time. It's like, it's flabbergasting.
With a lifetime of indoctrination. It starts in the kindergarten, people like you and I have a long battle on our hands to overcome this. The average American is just subjected to this indoctrination that the U.S. government means well, that it's the most honorable and liberal government in the world, and this is reinforced in elementary school and high school, on college and on television, in the print media. It's a major task for the likes of you and I to overcome this kind of upbringing. It's amazing that there are already many millions of Americans who have seen through our foreign policy despite this upbringing. So we have something to be proud of, I think.
We're speaking with William Blum, the author of America's Deadliest Export, Democracy, The Truth About U.S. Foreign Policy and Everything Else. Completely brilliant book.
Just ticking off the various chapters is quite extraordinary. Terrorism, Iraq, Afghanistan, Iran, Bush, Condoleezza Rice, WikiLeaks, conspiracies, Yugoslavia, Libya, Cuba, the Cold War and anti-communism, ideology and society, the media, Barack Obama, religion. You've, over the years, and I think you've got a lot of them under your belt like the three of us do, over the years you've really been able to figure it out.
You have a chapter devoted to the Obama administration. Could you talk a bit about empire and his relationship with building empire?
Well, I think that the main thing to understand about this man called Barack Obama is that there was nothing that he strongly believes in except being president of the United States. The man, I don't believe, has any core beliefs. Maybe he loves his family and things like that, and he likes basketball and hamburgers. But when it comes to foreign policy, any moral issue, he doesn't have any. He's not anti-empire. He's not pro-empire. He likes being president, and he'll do and say whatever it takes to remain in that office. And he knows what he has to do and say to win the support of those who finance his campaigns. Yeah, that's hard for the average American fan of Obama to accept. They're convinced that he is a very liberal person, and he's, in my opinion, in Europe, he would be regarded as center-right. Here, maybe at best, center. That's my pronouncement about Mr. Obama.
Yeah, no, I quite agree with you. Let's switch the subject from Obama to religion, because you had an appreciation of Christopher Hitchens. Our listeners may remember that Hitchens, who started off as a radical, came to support Bush's war in Iraq. Supported it because he said that Muslims were fanatic. Any super religious people, including Muslims, were fanatic, and therefore you had to fight them. You analyzed that position, and I thought it was really an intelligent way you went after it. You think that Muslims are born fanatics?
If you mean the so-called fanaticism, I agree. The many Muslims, so-called jihadists, are fanatics. If you look at what they do and what they claim to be the reason for. But as I've mentioned, maybe in the book itself, one could look at an American soldier and call him a fanatic just as well. You look at an American serviceman who drops bombs and missiles, drone attacks against and mosques and weddings and funerals. Isn't he a fanatic? And isn't he as much a true believer in what he's doing as any Muslim is? Yeah. He doesn't have to shout Allah Akbar. If he was going to shout anything, he might shout American exceptionalism. That's the religion that motivates most Americans, and certainly our servicemen. They think we're fighting for the good guys. If you look at the atrocities that we carry out, Iraq and Afghanistan and elsewhere, how do we differ from the Muslim fanatic? Often when I say things like this, people say, well, the bad things that we've done have been by accident. Would the Muslims do it on purpose? And I say, if you send out a plane on Monday and it bombs a village and it kills dozens of innocent people, in addition to maybe one bad guy, and then the American military says, oh, that was a mistake, we apologize. And then on Tuesday, you send out a plane again, and it kills many more innocent people again, and the military says, oh, that was a mistake, we apologize. And then the same thing happens on Wednesday and Thursday and Friday. At what point does the U.S. military lose the right to say it was a mistake? And I say that is just as much on purpose as any terrorist act, which we read about daily in the press.
Bill, let me ask you about humanitarian intervention, which is the kind of ideological cover that you write about in terms of the United States justification for bombing Yugoslavia, Libya, and now they're talking about it with respect to Syria.
Right.
And could you elaborate on that, please?
Yeah, Obama has just appointed two women who are champions of that philosophy. Samantha Power is the author of a book on that very subject, on humanitarian intervention, and she's a passionate believer that the U.S. Means well, and in any intervention is done for the best of reasons. Obama appointing these two women with this philosophy shows that he stands behind that philosophy. And I don't think you can expect any changes. I can't say just to what extent all these people sincerely and deeply and really believe what they're saying. But that's what they say, and that's what they've been saying for years, and that's what their behavior supports. So we have to assume that they are really believers in their humanitarian interventions, and that's not going to change in the near future.
Mr. Bloom, I wanted to read two sentences from your final chapter. You write, "The education which Occupy," and you're speaking about the Occupy movement, "has caused to be thrust upon the citizenry about corporate abuse and criminality, political corruption, inequality, poverty, and so on, virtually all unprosecuted, would be highly significant if America were a democracy. But as it is, more and more people can learn more and more about these matters and get more and more angry, but have nowhere to turn to effectuate meaningful change." We always try to ask our guests, what can people do? And I think you're right, we're not in a democracy, and people can educate themselves, but what kinds of actions do you recommend? I think you quoted Howard Zinn, and he said persistence is important.
Yeah, what I say usually is the only thing we have at our disposal is education. I think our numbers are growing. People who think like us, certainly in the millions now, we have to keep at it. At some point, hopefully and theoretically, our numbers will reach a critical mass, at which point there will be some kind of explosion. And I can't begin to tell you now what form that explosion will take or what the effect of it will be. But that's the belief which motivates me and which I attempt to pass on to other people. If you don't believe that even that much, then there's no hope at all.
Well, without hope, as Ramsey Clark tells us, you know, people don't do anything, and we do have hope. You know, what did King say, that the moral arc of history is a long one?
Right.
And indeed it is. But educating yourself helps accelerate that arc. And your book, Bill, America's Deadliest Export, Democracy, is really a very helpful piece of that educational project.
Can I mention my website?
Certainly.
It's williambloom.org, and you can read about all my books there.
And they can get your newsletter if they go to that website, too.
I have a monthly newsletter called The Anti-Empire Report on the Internet, and that's free.
I read it every month. Thank you, Bill. And thanks so much for your book and for being on Law and Disorder.
I really appreciate the book, Bill. It's just wonderful.
Bye-bye, my friend.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
Like a walking razor, don't you watch my size, I'm dangerous, said I'm dangerous. I'm like a walking razor, don't you watch my size, I'm dangerous, dangerous. If you are a bully, treat me good. If you are a bully, I beg you treat me. Like a stepping razor, don't you watch my size, I'm dangerous, dangerous. I'm like a stepping razor, don't you watch my size, I'm dangerous, dangerous. If you are a jockey.
The new documentary, Dirty Wars, The World is a Battlefield, provides a unique look into covert wars brought by the United States. The film follows investigative reporter and author of the book by the same name, Jeremy Scahill, into Afghanistan, Somalia, and Yemen, and analyzes expanded U.S. drone warfare and the foreign policy that has allowed this destruction to take place. The film's director, Rick Rowley, and Scahill went into these covert war zones to speak with families about what they've seen and to humanize their stories. As we've reported on Law and Disorder, the Obama administration has continued to normalize the Bush administration policies by empowering the Joint Special Operations Command and the use of drones. We're joined today by the film's director, Rick Rowley, to discuss the making of this powerful film, Dirty Wars. Rick, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thanks for having me.
Now, your new documentary, Dirty Wars, The World is a Battlefield, just opened a few days ago in New York City. Tell us first, what's the film about? How'd you get involved?
The film is about the global covert war on terror. And, you know, Jeremy and I, we've been war reporters for over a decade. And I became a war reporter because I really thought that the global war on terror was the most important story of our generation. It was the longest running war in American history, you know, over a decade long, killed hundreds of thousands of people, cost untold billions of dollars. And yet most of it was unfolding in the shadows. We knew almost, you know, next to nothing about it. And, you know, around the world today, there are dozens of wars being fought in our name, but without our knowledge and without any sort of meaningful oversight. But that actually, a lot of that has had to be constructed in hindsight, because when Jeremy and I began shooting this film, we thought it was a film just about Afghanistan. I'd been embedded and unembedded reporting in the country, and Jeremy had been doing research on the war and covering the war as well. And what we were seeing was that the covert war in Afghanistan was eclipsing the conventional war. I mean, I would be embedded with Marine units in Marja during the Marja surge, or, you know, with Army units all over the country. And you would see nothing. You know, you'd travel around embedded with these units, and they would, you know, dig wells or build schools that everyone was too afraid to attend. And they would go on meaningless presence patrols where they were just hoping to get shot at so they could return fire. So you would travel around all day and film nothing. And then at night, you would hear about night raids that were happening across the country where, you know, scores of Taliban sub-commanders were being killed or captured. But no one could tell you anything about these raids. They wouldn't tell you what units they were in. The public affairs officers would give you no details. No one was ever offered up for interviews, and you certainly couldn't embed with the units who were doing it. So it reached a point where, as you know, it's true today, more Afghans are killed and captured by covert units than by the entire 100,000-strong NATO force that's there. So we began the film to try to find out what was up behind that.
Now, how are covert units formed? How did they come to be? How are they trained? Who oversees them?
So that's the thing that was so strange about this all. We leave the green zone, we unembed ourselves, and we go out sort of following the trail of press releases to go to the sites where every night raid had happened to try to figure out what was going on. We arrive, one of the raids that we covered was a raid in which two pregnant women were killed. And the press release that the military put out was that it was a Taliban honor killing that they stumbled upon, that the U.S. soldiers were not responsible for it. So over the course of, you know, a dogged investigation, it's demonstrated and proven that the U.S. was in fact responsible. And so eventually they apologized for it. They changed their press release and they tried to flip it. So it seemed like our story was done. Case closed. Americans are responsible. You know, that's the end of it. But we had this photograph that wasn't supposed to exist. A week after they retracted their first press release about how the killings happened, there was a long convoy, a military convoy, rolled up to this compound, and a U.S. admiral, who no one knew or recognized there, got out and offered to sacrifice two sheep in apology for killing the family and admitted that his troops were responsible for it. So we have the picture of this admiral, but we didn't know who he was. He was Admiral William McRaven, who at the time was completely unknown. He wasn't from NATO command in Bagram, in Kabul. He wasn't part of RC East. So Jeremy very quickly discovered through his research that he's the leader of the Joint Special Operations Command. Now he's famous because he led the unit, he led the mission that killed Osama bin Laden. But when we began this thing, he was totally unknown. So that's the thing that it was so incongruous. This is a unit that initially numbered in only a few hundred guys who was supposed to do the most high-level strategic missions. They're supposed to hostage rescue missions. If a nuclear weapon is stolen from the Ukraine, like they go and recapture it. That's what they're supposed to do. They maybe take out a terrorist mastermind somewhere. They're doing 15 to 20 raids a night across Afghanistan, thousands of raids a year, going after not terrorists, not al-Qaeda members even, but after mid-level Taliban field commanders and people, you know, farmers who might, you know, and they have terrible intelligence, so many times it's the wrong people even, but yeah, they're being used. The entire war is being fought by this clandestine force that was never really built for this kind of operation.
Rick Rowley, you directed Dirty Wars. You call it The Whole World is a Battlefield. Talk about the various battlefields. What's going on?
Yeah, so we, in Afghanistan, we never imagined that we would be taken on the, you know, we thought the film would end there. But when we discovered that this unit was behind these raids, we started to trace other places where the unit was, where JSOC was operating. And that brought us to Yemen, where there are, you know, regular drone strikes and other operations that they're coordinating, and to Somalia, where proxy forces, you know, warlord armies are sort of, the kill list has been outsourced to them. Then the broader kind of scope of it was just staggering, that there are, under the Al-Qaeda Network Execute Order, the AQNX order it was called under the Bush administration, the JSOC was authorized to operate in 26 countries without, you know, clandestinely. Under Obama, that was raised first to 76 or 78 countries, and then now it was disclosed by, you know, unnamed sources, I think to the New York Times a while ago, that there was a day last year when there were JSOC troops on the ground in 100 countries on the same day. So the scale of this, that's the thing that makes this different. I mean, you know, listeners of WBAI know that assassinations have been going on for a very long time. They've been going on all over the world. And you know, regular Americans expect there to be some covert, ugly things that, you know, probably should be cleaned up or stopped that are going on out of sight. You know what I did too? I'm not naive, but I was staggered by just the massive scale of this, a wholesale assassination machine.
Now, talk about the kill lists. Who's on these lists? Were you able to see any of them?
They're all classified. No one knows what gets you on a kill list or what gets you off a kill list. No one knows how many names are on the list. Here's the few things we know. On September 11th, there were, you know, a dozen people on the kill list. In Iraq, they printed a deck of cards with, you know, 55 more names that were on the kill list there. By the time we got to Afghanistan, we know there were thousands of people on the kill list. Globally, you know, I mean, who knows? And they're different, you know, they keep changing the name. They call them, you know, the disposition matrix, the kill list, the JPEL lists. The thing is one of the JSOC, a former JSOC operator said in our film, in an interview, is, you know, you get a list with 50 or 200 guys on it, and you can work your way through those 50 or 200 guys. But when you get to the bottom of that list, you're given a new list with 3,000 people on it. And so how does that grow? I mean, how does that list grow? It's a bottomless list. It's a permanent cycle of violence being managed around the world.
We've discussed this with Ray McGovern, the former CIA analyst, who said that John Brennan and Obama meet every Tuesday. They call it Terror Tuesday, and they go over this list to decide who's going to be killed. The Attorney General has said that because they give it their considered opinion, that this is due process. Hmm. Do you discuss in the movie how these targets are pinpointed and who decides what to do with them?
Yeah. I mean, I'm not a lawyer, but that idea of due process makes a mockery of everything that I understand the Constitution to guarantee. I mean, it just is astounding that the executive wing is claiming the right to be judge, jury, and executioner in these cases. But we interview Ron Wyden from the Senate Intelligence Committee and try to talk to him about these things. But he's a guy who's trying to push for more disclosure and more transparency in the Senate. But for the entire interview, there's a lawyer, an aide inside the office who has to keep stopping him. And so when we're asking the most basic questions, so Jeremy asks him, so, you know, I'd like you to sort of talk about when there is a lethal operation that happens off a war zone, and then he's interrupted. No, I'm sorry, I can't admit that there have been any lethal operations outside of war zones, including bin Laden, including the drone strikes that are acknowledged in Pakistan like every day. You know, in the Bradley Manning trial, one of the things that the prosecution wants to present as evidence is a Navy SEAL who was part of the bin Laden raid to testify, you know, that he saw evidence that WikiLeaks was somehow important in that. But they don't want to admit that the bin Laden raid actually happened in court. And so, like, how can you, there's a Hollywood film made about it. It's been, the president has talked about it multiple times on camera, and yet they like pretend like it doesn't exist. So anyway, but the point is, Ron Wyden says to us on camera, you know, the American people have a right to know when the president can kill them and when he can't. And yet we don't. There's, I mean, secret interpretations of laws that exist on the books that would be shocking to the American people if they knew about them. So it's a very, it's chilling what's happened. You know, it's been a decade. This is a decade long, more than a decade. This war has happened, and we haven't really had any national conversation about what it's doing to us as a country and doing to the world.
While you were interviewing subjects for this, did you ever feel that your life was endangered? What was the process like?
I mean, Jeremy and I both get asked those kinds of questions a lot, and it's almost embarrassing to us, you know, because the risks that we take are so small compared to the risks of the journalists that we work with around the world. Like in Yemen or Somalia and Iraq, I mean, record numbers of journalists are killed in Syria and elsewhere. I mean, the people who really put their lives on the line are the local reporters there. And so as an example, you know, in Yemen, we covered Obama's first missile strike on Yemen, which was in a tiny little Bedouin camp called Al-Majla, where, 46 people, I think, were killed, you know, dozens of women and children, of babies were wiped out by cruise missiles carrying cluster bombs on them. The reason why the world knows that that happened and why we were able to get there and cover that is because a very brave Yemeni journalist named Abdullah Hader Shaya went out immediately after the strike and he took photographs of the bomb parts and of the aftermath. And those, you know, Amnesty International then took them and had a munition expert study them and revealed that they were cruise missiles that, you know, they could only have been fired by the U.S. And he blew that story open. It became a national scandal in Yemen. And, a few weeks into that coverage, he was snatched off the street by the U.S.-trained Yemeni security forces who beat him up and told him, stop talking about Majla, and released him onto the street. He went straight from the security headquarters to Al Jazeera and went on the air and said, I've just been beaten up by Yemen's U.S.-trained counterterrorism forces for reporting on Majla, and I'm not going to stop. A little bit later, in the middle of the night, his house is surrounded by these same forces, and he disappears for 30 days, where he's held incommunicado in secret, locked in a bathroom stall for a week, and then he shows up finally in a court, in this kangaroo security court that the dictator of Yemen has set up to prosecute journalists for committing crimes against the state, basically, and he's got teeth missing and scars on his chest, and has been tortured, and it's a sham trial. And he's sentenced to 5 years for being a facilitator or something ridiculous like that, a propagandist or something. And there's national outcry. There's outrage. There's, not just, popular uprising or protests in the street, but there's pressure from important and powerful tribes to release him. So finally, the dictator of Yemen, it says, okay, we're going to release him. There's too much pressure. It's not really worth it. And it's leaked to the press that that his pardon is going to happen later that day. The dictator of Yemen, Ali Abdullah Saleh, gets a phone call, not from some aide, but from President Obama himself, saying, we're very disturbed by your decision to release Abdullah Hader Shaya. We think he needs to stay in prison. Now, we heard this story many times in Yemen, and we're like, it sounds a little dubious. The president himself, for this one guy, it's published on the White House website. There's a readout from that phone call. And when Jeremy calls to like verify that they're, the State Department says, yeah, we stand behind that. We want him kept in jail. I mean, this is one of the most celebrated like Yemeni journalists held in prison. So next to the risk that he takes, the risks that Jeremy and I take are nothing.
Was he released?
No, he's still in prison. He's still in prison.
The U.S. didn't want him.
Yeah. No. The dictator is gone, and Hadi is the new president, who was his vice president and is still implicated in everything that happened before. But, there are steps after the Arab Spring there are steps to try to democratize the country. And so President Hadi had made indications that he might release Shaya. And so the State Department has reiterated their desire for Hadi to keep him in prison in spite of that fact.
Dirty wars, the world is a battlefield. We're speaking with Rick Rowley, who directed it. You won at Sundance, the best cinematographer. The movie was released in New York and around the country. Tell us what's been the reaction so far to this, quite extraordinary story.
It really has been amazing because, we knocked on so many doors in Afghanistan of investigating night raids of compounds where families answer and the last American they saw knocking or saw at their doorstep kicked the door in and killed half their family. And yet they sat down and talked with us and they shared their stories. They shared stories of the most painful time in their life. because, you know, we make the implicit and explicit promise that we'll do everything we can to have to share their stories in the U.S. And it's deeply humbling, not just because of that individual trust, but because it shows, you know, how much they believe in us as a country, really. You know, they believe more that sometimes it's hard to have as much faith as they do. They think that if the American people could only hear their story and have their story proven to be true, that somehow it would matter and make a difference. So you, as a journalist, you live in fear often that you're gonna betray that trust and that promise, that you're not gonna be able to get the story out, that the story will be killed by your editor or will be buried in the news cycle. And so it's really been amazing to be able to keep that promise. IFC is putting this film in dozens and dozens of theaters around the country, and the response has been amazing. You know, when we started this film 3 years ago, BAI was talking about drones and kill lists, but it took until like 6 months ago for that to work its way onto the editorial pages of the Times and the Post and work its way into the mainstream of American culture. I really feel and I hope that this is a moment where we as a country can begin finally a conversation we should have had 10 years ago about what this war is doing to us. And, you know, I hope this film could be a part of that.
As a journalist and a human being, if there was one experience in making this film that you will always remember that perhaps changed you, what would that have been?
There's so many, and I've been a war reporter for more than a decade, since for a big chunk of my adult life, and you start to feel kind of calloused to things and feel like you're invincible and invulnerable and you can film it all and carry it away and not be touched by it. But the trauma does kind of stick with you and carry with you. And the images that we've seen and recorded just can't be erased from my mind when it all ends. But the lowest moment filming, the moment when we're like seeing wonder about why the risk and why the trauma and why doing everything that it takes to do this was probably, was in Somalia when Jeremy and I were covering a country that has been just ripped to bloody pieces by decades of warlord rule and covert war. And, we were at a tea house and we left, and about 10 minutes later there was an IED attack there. And we rushed to the hospital and filmed the ICU unit, filmed, the surgeries happening. They went to the morgue, and we ended up being locked in the morgue because we arrived at the morgue, and then the families arrived to try to find their loved ones. And they were worried that if they came in and saw Americans there, that it would be bad for everyone. So I don't know how long we were in there for. It could have been, it felt like hours. And I was filming these horrifically mutilated bodies, knowing that I could never use the images because they're far too graphic and they would be senseless. They would, and for weeks after that, Jeremy said he couldn't get the taste of flesh off his tongue. It was just that feeling of being surrounded by death is with you. And it seems so bleak and empty and hopeless. But the thing that always kind of keeps me going is that, wherever you arrive, in Yemen or Somalia or in Afghanistan, and you talk to people in the heavy service, they like in Afghanistan, people would collect, the shell casings that had been left behind during their attacks, or in Yemen, the bits of missile parts that have a piece of a serial number or cell phone photos or whatever that they keep somewhere in their house, out in the middle of nowhere, and they've kept them. We realize, waiting for us to arrive. Waiting for someone to come and listen to their story and take their testimony and because they believe that their stories matter, and that if people knew and it could be proven that their stories were true, that it would change things. And so that is the burden we have.
Dirty Wars. The World is a Battlefield, the new movie that Rick Rowley, our guest, has directed and filmed. Rick, how does it strike you that the United States is kind of involved in setting up a perpetual motion machine? Because the more of this they do, the more hatred it encourages, then the more this that they have to do. I guess the term is blowback. How do you see that unfolding?
you know, that's a fear and a sentiment that is shared not just by people who have moral or political objections to this kind of violence, but by members of the very apparatuses that conduct these operations. Like Jeremy got on camera, you know, a number of whistleblowers who are current or former operators who were parts of JSOC or CIA people who are saying that these kinds of discussions about blowback are happening inside their own institutions. That a lot of people talk about this as or some of the operators as mowing the lawn. They're like, the insurgency or the jihadism will rise up to a certain level, and then you go and you like chop it off, but then the grass will rise again. So that's a war without an end game. That's permanently managing a level of acceptable chaos and violence. And when you see, you know, a country like Somalia, that's a place where we've been mowing the lawn for a very long time, and it's turned the country into a terrifying place. And I really, you know, after being in Iraq and Yemen and Somalia, being all over this war for years, I mean, I really feel and fear that we're creating more enemies than we can kill.
We're looking forward to seeing this film. Let me ask you this. Are there any heroes in the film? And by that, I mean any U.S. or Americans who are doing the right thing.
You know, there are people who it's been a lonely decade for a lot of folks. There are people in the film who've been, you know, Ron Wyden has taken, you know, heroic stances at different moments, but he's compromised by his location and is doing the best he can in the spot he is, I think, for where he's at. I mean, I really think that this war remains secret for a reason. That if the American people knew about it, that there would be popular outrage at what's being done in our name. And unfortunately, there aren't a lot of heroes. I mean, I think that it's up to now, but you know, there hasn't been a lot of consciousness about what has been happening. I mean, I think once we as a country see what has been hidden from us, what's been hidden in plain sight, I mean, that we will be the heroes that we're waiting for.
What's your next project? Are you now a filmmaker after having been an embedded reporter?
For the next 6 months, thinking about nothing but getting this film out. I mean, it's 3 years working on it, and it's just so amazing to finally be able to share it with audiences in America. So that's all I'm doing.
We've been speaking with Rick Rowley, who filmed the movie Dirty Wars, The World is a Battlefield. He went around with Jeremy Scahill, who wrote the book by the same title. It's coming out all over America. It's actually out now in a lot of places. We encourage you all to go see it. And Rick, we want to have you back on for a follow-up when we talk about how this helped build the anti-war movement in the United States.
Great. I can't wait to be here for that.
Thank you, Rick.
Thank you.
Thanks, Rick.
If you want to hear Law and Disorder again, go to lawanddisorder.org on the web. You should also go to Law and Disorder Radio on Facebook.